Hey there, welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm glad you tuned in today. I'm Bill Radke. I haven't been bored since I was a child, especially since smartphones came along. I'm just never bored. I have interesting in my pocket. But is that really such a good thing? You're about to meet the author of the new book, Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. Hop on Twitter right now, at KUOW. You have a decision to make in the city of Seattle. You know your primary ballots due, right? I've been telling you this about 3 weeks before your primary ballots due, and your current mayor is not an option. Ed Murray's not running for re-election. We're helping you get to know the people who would like to replace him, and today I'm with Carrie Moon. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. I know you as an urban planner and as an engineer. What don't we know about you that we ought?
Well, first, since you brought it up, of the 21 people on the ballot, my name is first, so that feels like good karma.
How'd you do that?
I don't know. Just good luck.
Uh-huh. Okay. Carrie Moon. that could be turned into a slogan. Carrie Moon, number one. You said that you would take no corporate money for this campaign. You're a political first-timer, right?
Yep.
Still true? No corporate money?
Still true, yep. I believe that the influence of corporations over our democracy is corroding our whole system. And I helped make the Honest Election Seattle plan work, and I've been working on something similar at the state level that we just launched called the Democracy Hub. So this is a principle that means a lot to me, that democracy should be run by the people, for the people, of the people, and corporations should stay the heck out of it.
Self-funding.
Somewhat. I mean, I'm raising money, but I'm also matching with my own money because it allows me to have more time with voters out talking to people about real issues.
The issue I most associate with you, you won't be surprised, is, you know, as you and I speak, there is a tunnel growing underneath the Seattle waterfront coming together. You fought that tunnel. You also didn't want a big above-ground highway on the waterfront. You said, let's just knock down the Alaskan Way Viaduct and keep it down. Why did the city and the state not get Carrie Moon's waterfront vision?
Well, you know, in some ways, they did get it. So the waterfront is happening. We are building 22 acres of civic space in the heart of our downtown, which I helped plan and launch and envision and build the public will for. Incredibly proud of that, and I cannot wait to see that come to fruition. And regarding the transportation solution, you know, at one point in this process, we almost won because we were proposing about $2 billion worth of investments in additional transit and street improvements to get people in and out of the city. And at one point, the head of the city, the state, and the county DOT all said this was the best plan and better than any other plans on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And the politics around mega projects and, you know, Chamber of Commerce and who the governor has to listen to keep people happy really kind of took control of the situation, and they ended up not pursuing the recommended alternative.
Well, it is a state highway. 99 is a state highway. Right. I-5 is cloggy. How are we going to get people and goods through the city?
Well, if you look at who uses the viaduct, it's primarily people coming in and out of downtown. And so our solution was aimed at that. How do we get people in and out of downtown on transit, on street improvements? And, you know, the tunnel is a bypass highway, so we still haven't really solved that problem. And if we had invested in transit the way we were proposing 10 years ago, you know, we might not be facing some of these problems we have now. But let me just say that, you know, the tunnel is happening. It's, you know, it's coming, and the discussion's over at this point. But
you're not plugging the hole.
No, nope, not plugging the hole.
What about, as mayor, would you toll the hell out of the tunnel so we don't drive it? You want fewer cars on the road.
You know, if you've raised tolls too high, that just pushed people onto city streets, which have not been improved, adding to the congestion problem. So we do have to find the right balance. If we're going to have the piece of infrastructure, we might as well use it efficiently.
We, of course, went to KUOW's Facebook page to solicit questions. Great questions at KUOW.org and on Facebook. And Audra says, number one, fix our roads. What is your plan to improve the roads in this city? The bottleneck on I-5 around the convention center should be addressed. That is a chunk of your constituency that, you know, you're thinking transit. They're thinking roads, roads, roads.
I think if you just look at the math of it, the rate at which we're growing, more and more people are moving here. And so we have to use the road space we have as efficiently as possible. We can't add new roads at this point. And so if you look at what kind of systems move the most people, it's light rail, it's transit, it's bikes, it's pedestrians, and then it's cars. So we have got to invest in the modes that move the most people in the least amount of space, and that's the way to solve the congestion problem.
On KUOW's Facebook page, the issue that our listeners named Seattle's top challenge is the cost of housing, no surprise. How would your approach be different from Mayor Murray's approach to the cost of housing?
So Mayor Murray has had this approach of the free market will do what it will, and let's just get the developers, you know, to build 5 to 10% of their housing as affordable housing, and that should be enough. And that is nowhere near enough. We need much bolder, more transformative solutions. So I'm proposing three kind of distinct approaches. First, we have got to put a tax on the speculation that's part of driving up demand for housing in our city. So corporations and outsiders, non-residents, are investing in our housing because it's the hottest return on investment out there.
Even what's wrong with that? Everybody wants their investment to grow.
I don't think so, because that's what's driving up property taxes, and it's what's driving up rents, and it's what's pushing people out of the city. And so we have got to curtail that activity and focus on housing for people who live here. Second, so we have to build a lot more affordable housing. The only cities that don't have this crisis have a huge percentage of their housing in public and nonprofit ownership because it dampens the volatility in the market and it provides that much more housing for, you know, working people. And then we have to look at building the missing middle, all the types of housing like row houses and duplexes and backyard cottages, congregate housing, those kind of types of housing that could be affordable that the private market would build if we made them more viable and legal in our city.
Upzone Seattle's single-family neighborhoods?
Appropriately, with a scalpel, you know, not an axe. I think we need to really look at what fits in neighborhoods. There's a lot of housing types like duplexes, like row houses that are a lot denser than what we're building now that people would welcome if we had a range of options on the table. People could sort of help understand what kind of growth they need to accept and what works in their neighborhood. And I don't think we'll have a problem coming to an agreement once we open up the toolkit of the different kinds of models.
You talked about speculators. I'm guessing, well, this is a question from Clint. Would you consider a vacancy/empty home tax like Vancouver, BC?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, you're into
I think
that.
Both.
Okay.
And looking at a additional real estate excise tax on luxury properties, whatever we can do to stop the speculation that is taking housing away from people who want to live here.
Has there been a booming American city where people don't get priced out? I mean, what city is your model?
Well, there are cities in Europe that have built a lot of affordable housing that show that it dampens the overall volatility. And then some of the luxury vacation destinations have solved this problem. Aspen, Colorado, for instance. In the 70s, they realized all these rich people are buying up our housing stock to come ski for 2 weeks a year. That's not working for the people who live and work here. So they started building a lot of affordable housing, and they limit who's allowed to buy housing in their city, and it's worked out pretty well. They're a small city with a unique condition, but it's a model that we could look at.
I'm talking with Carrie Moon, who's running for the mayor of Seattle. She's a political first-timer, as was Mike McGinn when he was mayor. McGinn is running again, and he told me that his inexperience sometimes worked against him. Why should we elect another political first-timer?
Well, I'm not inexperienced. I'm a professional urban planner. I've been working on civic issues for 20 years. I've been working with all the departments in the city and with the advocacy arena for 20 years. So I have a lot of experience with how do the levers of government work? Where do decisions get made? What are the forces affecting power? I understand that in a way that I don't think he did at the time. But more importantly, I'm a more collaborative leader. I work with people to set a shared vision and build a unified effort towards that vision. That's the way I operate. That's why the People's Waterfront Coalition built as much momentum as it did, because it was a collaboration across lots of organizations inside and outside of city government. And that's the way I lead. And he's a much more combative us versus them sort of kind of manager. And that's not my approach. Let's all do this together because we all have this shared common goal.
Let's talk about police. This has been an ongoing problem. Police, overuse of force, the appearance of bias, as you well know. And Ness on our Facebook page asks, what are you going to do about the ongoing refusal of the SPD to undertake any smidgen of meaningful reform and drastically reduce deaths by police bullets? I don't know that's your take on it, but how do you respond?
I challenge your phrase, the appearance of bias, because I think we all need to address, we have real bias in our society. It's not just in the police. We have systemic racism. We were all born into it. We're all, you know, maybe we didn't invent it. Maybe we're not actively perpetuating it, but we're part of it. And so we all have to acknowledge that that is reality in our city, and it gets expressed in lots of ways, and we see it most visibly in the police department. So I just want to establish that as the ground.
Yeah.
And
I'm talking about the federal monitor, you know, the federal police finding, the DOJ finding of overuse of force, and they didn't say bias policing, but the appearance of, anyway, but you're saying that bias is a real thing.
Yep.
There's no
Let's
question
admit
there.
It's real.
Yeah.
And then I think we need to just keep going farther. We need to do a lot more racial equity training. We need to do a lot more de-escalation training and have, you know, people have alternatives to alternatives to use of force.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at, you know, the Community Policing Commission and what their role can be in shining a spotlight on things that we think we're doing well, but we're actually not. We need to make sure we fund them and we listen to them. And we need to keep going with the alternatives to incarceration, especially for youth offenders. There's about 20 different things we need to be doing actively with our police department and in the broader community to reduce racial bias and use of force. And I would be committed to funding all of them and making them a top priority, because I feel like with Block the Bunker, with No New Youth Jail, and now with the emergence of anger, frustration, activism around the Charlena Lyles killing, we are in a civil rights moment in Seattle, and it is time to make the changes that we know we need to make now.
I've been asking this of, still on the subject of race, asking this question of other mayoral candidates on Facebook. Zach says, Seattle's biggest challenge is addressing its own white supremacy. There's racism everywhere. Do you think Seattle is especially institutionally racist?
I think maybe not, but I think we pretend we're good. Mm. We pretend, you know, we're all liberals mostly, and we give ourselves a pass because we don't express overt, you know, interpersonal malice. We don't have the KKK here, so we think we're fine. But we do have a lot of institutions that manage to privilege the interests of white people and people with power and money again and again over people of color and people who are lower economic status. And we keep perpetuating that system. So I think it's time that we confront that, understand how it works, understand what are the barriers to access for people of color, understand, you know, how to share power across race, class, and gender, how to look at all our investments that we're making with public money using a racial equity lens of how can we make sure the money we're spending now is reversing decades or centuries of inequality, and just make commitments to it in every single arena of government.
I get this question from friends of mine, because I live on Mercer Island, and I have friends who say I shouldn't have abandoned the Seattle school system. I live on Mercer Island partly because I really like the school that my kids go to. And you have, your kids go to private school, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find any, you want Seattle to be more equitable. Your kids are in private school. Do you find any contradiction in that?
Absolutely. It's been a big conflict in my family, in my life, ever since we made that decision. But, you know, every family has its own unique conditions. My kids live in two houses. And the choice we were, and neither house has a car, and the choice we were offered was across the Ship Canal. And there was just no way we were going to send our kids to a school across the Ship Canal every day and make that trip four times a day. And so we thought, what are our alternatives? A place that we can, everybody can walk to. And so we chose private school, but we spent elementary school years in public school system and loved it. And if we had been offered a choice that worked for our family's needs, we would have stayed. But that said, I think the core problem of the public school system in Seattle is lack of funding because of McCleary, and we have to solve that problem at its root. We have got to get sufficient funding into the school system so they can offer the kinds of programs and the kinds of facilities and, you know, the education kids need, because every kid deserves to have a great start in life through a great education.
Well, maybe we'll both come back. Talking with Carrie Moon, who's a candidate for mayor, some UW researchers just reported if Seattle brings hockey or basketball to Key Arena instead of SoDo, it'll be kissing off millions of dollars in revenue. By the way, that study was commissioned by the SoDo Arena folks. But what do you want to do, if anything, with more pro sports around here?
I think it would be fantastic if we could bring the Sonics back. I love basketball. I love watching basketball. It's my favorite sport to watch. And I think both proposals are have a lot of pros and cons. And I lean towards Key Arena because I believe in preserving industrial land. And I believe that Seattle Center is a great venue for civic activity. But it comes with a really steep challenge of how do we get people there, given the Mercer mess and given the lack of transit to that neighborhood until light rail opens. So it comes with a lot of challenges, but I would like to make sure we're trying to tackle all those challenges and come up with a good solution there. If we can't, I would look at SoDo, making sure we are not building the whole entertainment district, just the arena and preserve industrial land.
Carrie Moon, this may sound ridiculous, but I have personally heard people confuse you with Molly Moon, the ice cream maker. Have you heard that as well?
Yes.
Go on.
I would love it if Molly Moon were my sister.
Uh-huh.
She's not.
Is this bad for your campaign or fantastic for your campaign?
I like
vote Molly Moon.
Vote ice cream. Yeah. Yes, it's great for my campaign. And it's funny because I do have a sister named Molly Moon, but she lives in Indiana.
No kidding. I bet she really gets mixed up. That's why she lives in Indiana, not here. Okay, because I would vote for a bowl of honey lavender for mayor, so I was curious what you thought about that. Anything that our time's about up. What did I just blow it by not asking you about?
You know, I think the difference between having an outsider who's skilled and a professional urban planner who really understands urban growth and urban development and how to get ahead of growth, how to have compact, equitable growth. I think we're crying for that in our city right now. We've had a lot of mayors who don't quite understand that, who play politics a different way. And I think people are ready for real solutions because people feel this unease, like, am I going to belong here in the future? Is this still my city? Who's in charge? How is it changing so quickly? And I think having more of a vision and a concrete action plan and someone who knows about urban growth at the helm, I think would be really welcome by people.
Carrie Moon, would like your vote for a mayor of Seattle, and we're about 3 weeks from your primary ballot being due. Carrie, thank you for this.
Yeah, thank you.
This is KOW's The Record. We're going to go to a different city where they've got some similar challenges. You know, Tacoma's dealing with homelessness in part by banning sleeping on public property. So we're going to have that discussion coming up on The Record. Hope you can stick around. It's KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Are you bored right now? Gee, I hope not. I might take that personally. But, you know, boredom is a thing. We've all dealt with it. In fact, according to a University of Virginia study, some of us will do almost anything to avoid boredom.
They put a bunch of people in a room without anything but an electric shock machine, and people would rather shock themselves than just sit and be bored.
Yeah, that's how bad boredom is to some people. That grim tale is from Mary Mann, the author of the new book, Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. She says, throughout history, no one has been safe from crushing boredom, even monks.
They were out in the wilderness and just prayed all the time. And they wrote about this feeling that just sucked them under, where all they wanted to do was wander around, and they were irritable, and they were listless, and they were just like ready to jump out of their skin.
Even monks.
Before there was an English word for boredom, actually.
Maybe we should define boredom, Mary. What are we talking about when you say boredom?
My definition of boredom is that it's restless irritability. It's a feeling, just like anger, just like happiness, just like sadness. It's a feeling, comes and goes.
Well, why do we get bored? I mean, we have an entire world around us. If I have the luxury of being bored because no animal is chasing me, why don't I just be interested in this thing over here or this thought I'm having? Why do we feel boredom?
There are a couple different theories about that. One of the ones that I think is most interesting comes from a researcher named Wijnand van Tilburg, who says that it's an emotional signal that makes people aware that in their current situation, there's a lack of purpose. So it helps us figure out what we would rather be doing, what we'd like to be doing. And if you think about what boredom is and all the things that we do that we don't need to be doing necessarily as a culture or as individuals, it's a source of a lot of cool stuff. Like, we wouldn't need to have books or TV or movies or radio. Hey,
uh-oh.
If we never got
Wait
bored.
A second. Cut off the microphone. Is there something wrong with whether it's radio or TV or my smartphone. It's a story. It's engaging. Is there something wrong with stopping the boredom by turning to a distraction?
It's a good question, and it's an important question because it comes up so much now. There's definitely an oversimplification of this idea that, like, it's good to be bored, so put away your phone. It doesn't seem like having a phone is keeping anyone from being bored. There was actually, MTV did a study that found that 97% of teens worldwide are often bored, and that mindlessly browsing the internet was one of the activities that they found most boring. So people can get bored doing all kinds of things. It's something that I sometimes call like busy bored, like when you're doing a lot of stuff, but none of it's really engaging you.
Did anything you found out in the course of the book change how you feel about your own boredom?
Well, certainly made it less shameful. Like I don't feel embarrassed to talk about it anymore. Research in this was very exploratory, and what I found mostly was that it's really different for everyone. Like I spoke to an accountant who loves doing tax forms. He thinks there's nothing at all boring about that. I talked to an actress who says that she thinks boredom is really useful for her on set because, like, after 40 takes, you're so bored that you stop caring and then you're acting naturally, which is what every actor wants to do.
What do we not know about boredom? We all think we know what boredom is. What are we not getting about boredom?
One thing that interested me the most was the other side of it, which is like the fear of being boring. It's apparently a very common adult fear, and I would agree with that. Sometimes I worry about it, certainly. One of the more interesting things that I came across while looking into that was I got a chance to speak to one of the guys behind the Dos Equis Most Interesting Man.
Yeah, that's what we
campaign.
All want to be.
You know,
we're deathly afraid of being boring. We want to be the most interesting man.
Yeah, so I got to talk to one of the guys behind that, and he was telling me that he had an ex-girlfriend a long time ago who used to tell him jokingly that he was boring, and he said nothing would make him more apoplectic. Like, it enraged him to hear that he was boring. And I thought it was just amazing that he ended up creating this character, helping to create this character who was no one could say that about.
I'm afraid of being boring. It's like if I imagine that I'm presenting myself and people are not interested, it's like I don't matter. I'm going to live and die and no one will have cared.
Yeah,
it runs
terrifying.
Deep. You feel that?
It's maybe one of the meanest things you could say to someone, I guess, because I hate you at least implies that you care.
Yeah.
Like I care enough to have a feeling about you, whereas... If someone bores you, it's hurtful to say that someone bores you.
You know what? Maybe we should revolt against the fear of being boring. Because why should I entertain other people? Why should I pander to them? Maybe it's a good sign if I'm so in my own flow that other people are not getting what they want from me.
Yeah, push back against it. I think anything that seems boring, anything can seem boring, and anything can be interesting if you dig into it.
I agree with
which
that.
Which was... what I learned from this, because I think boredom seems boring, but reading about it was really fun.
The book is Yawn, Adventures in Boredom, and I've been talking about it with author Mary Mann. Mary, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you, Bill. This has been great.
KUOW is The Record. Then there are the conversations we have with our children about being bored. And I tell them, oh, you don't have to be bored. And I feel bad if they're bored. Oh, I'm sending them into the world just unable to cope with nothing to offer. What have I done? We want to talk now about conversations we have with children around really terrible things. Because unfortunately, we don't just get to talk to them about homework and skateboards. A child may ask you a question like, how come people do terrible things? Why do people kill each other? And you got to figure out how to answer that question. And if you have struggled with that, you know what it means to translate, because to explain something difficult so it's meaningful for a child and yet still captures what is true, that's a tough translation. KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, brings us some local poetry now, grappling with this issue of translating the world for her own kids. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Bill.
Who is the poet working through this issue?
Her name is Lina Halef Tufaha. She's a local poet and translator, and she's the mother of three school-age daughters. For Lina, the task of helping her children cope with the violence in the world is complicated by the fact that she's both an American and an Arab of Palestinian, Jordanian, and Syrian heritage. She spent much of her childhood living in Jordan, and she still has many friends and family members living in the region. So I recently asked her into the studio to talk with me about her new poetry collection, Water and Salt. Here she is introducing and reading her poem, Again and Again.
So Again and Again is one of the poems that came out of the time period of the most recent war in Gaza. And it's one of those parent translating poems. My youngest especially, I think it was the first war that she was very aware of. And she was watching us watch it unfold. And that was extreme. It was an extreme stress for her. And she had a lot of questions. And every time we go through one of these episodes, I have to repeat the same answers, and they become more and more absurd. And so that repetition, that sort of unfortunate anaphora of these answers is what drove this meditation. Again and again, my daughter asks me to explain, but my words falter. I try numbers, dates of accords made and broken, defeats and victories, numbers of casualties, refugees, United Nations resolutions. My daughter doesn't want to know how. She isn't asking for the play-by-play of death that engulfs us. The trails of the dispossessed I watched in childhood are identical to the ones she sees today. More limbs trapped and swelling beneath crumbling concrete. More streets crowding with the dying, trying to outrun the dead. The Godzilla of sulfurous smoke, the bombs that rain, 1,000 miniature poisonous spears chasing them down. Somehow, all these decades later, all we can do is watch with different lenses and on flatter screens. My daughter wants to know why. Why must the living walk alongside ghosts marching out of black and white photographs and into the fresh rubble, still seething and bloodstained? My daughter wants to know why, instead of never again, which she took into her tender heart as a sacred oath nestled in the pages of her history books, and surveying the smoldering expanses of human apathy, why is it always again and again somewhere? Why must we live in the prison of the past and gather at its altar for more bloodletting?
Oh, she's so good. You know, something that stands out to me in that poem is never again, that our listeners might know that phrase that came out of Hitler's Holocaust, never again. And it's like it has gone from a vow to a hope to a lie from a child's point of view.
Exactly. I resonate with the same thing and with the earnestness of that question and of the predicament that the speaker as the parent is in, of there is no good explanation. And as Lina said in her introduction, the more she has to repeat this, the more absurd it becomes.
Yeah, it's not never again, it's always again from this little girl thing.
Seemingly so. You know, you hopefully heard as she was introducing the poem, Lina referred to it as one of those parent translating poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her what she meant by that.
We've been talking about our history, in our house, and so we refer to things as the past that aren't actually past. And so the truth of the matter is that a lot of the events that we describe as past are still unfolding. For example, you know, next week is the 50th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So a lot of the suffering that directly impacts people we love, our family members who live there, isn't past, it's ongoing. And our children's questions force us to explain something we've described as the past and then force us to admit to ourselves and to them that it's still ongoing. And you engage it a different way when you acknowledge that. You know, our family is Palestinian and Jordanian and Syrian. And so the places where this is most immediately evident are Palestine and Syria right now, but there is great suffering across the region, as we've seen. And I think that's also part of the point, that empathy, if you come from a place that is hurting and where there is strife, hopefully what happens is you develop an empathy for people in other places, that your sense of responsibility and humanity isn't limited to your own tribe in any way. That at minimum, this gives you a kind of compassion for anyone who is struggling.
Boy, I sure relate to being forced to explain by children. What she said in her earlier poem we just heard, she said, "My daughter doesn't want to know how," and then later she wants to know why. Yeah, the kids will do that.
I don't have children myself. I don't envy any of you that task. Mm. So we have been talking about how Lina Khalaf Tufaha uses her poems in part to translate for her daughters. But Bill, I want you to hear another poem from Water and Salt. This is one where Lina reflects on her own childhood education in poetry as she was growing up in Jordan. It's called Copybooks, as in the notebook where you practice writing.
Copybooks. Our teachers were kind in the way that people who have sipped tea or shopped at the local bakery with your parents would be. They taught us to stand upright and motionless when people who had control over our lives walked into the room. They taught us to chant at the daily morning assembly praises for the king and the country and the right heroes and the important revolutions. They taught us so well, some of us believed the chants, drank them into our bloodstreams, and loved the stick figure histories of the songs. They taught us to copy in perfect curlicues and lofty upstrokes across the page, beautiful equations they solved for us, and facts about combustion and the life cycle of honeybees. Most of their teachings served us well. We live in the shadow of leaders' palaces. There are always long lines, so good posture and deference are our currency. But best of all, they taught us poetry. They tucked gleaming verses into our hearts and let them sleep for years. They said, "Remember these words. This is where you are from. Write this in your copybooks."
That's Lina Khalaf Tufaha reading copybooks from her new poetry collection, Water and Salt. Lina, when you read that poem, are there parts of poems in Arabic that you memorized as a child that come to mind?
Yes, so many. That's such a huge part of growing up in the Arab world. There's such an unabashed love for poetry, and part of sort of Arabic literature is learning poems and memorizing them, both classical odes and sometimes more modern poems, like the poems of Mahmoud Darwish, aren't all rhymed, but many of us memorize them.
Is there one that comes to mind right now as you're telling me this?
Oh, my goodness. The lines of poetry that I have never forgotten since the first time I learned them are lines by the poet Antara bin Shaddad. He's one of the pre-Islamic bards of Arabia. And the lines are, وَلَقَدْ ذَكَرْتُكِ وَالرِّمَاحُ نَوَاهِلٌ مِنِّي وَبِيضُ الْهِنْدِ تَقْتُرُ مِنْ دَمِي فَوَدَدْتُ تَقْبِيلَ السُّيُوفِ لِأَنَّهَا لَمَعَتْ كَبَارِقِ ثَغْرِكِ الْمُتَبَسِّمِ. And it's, you know, a typically over-the-top romantic verse that in some ways reminds me of the poem Turisa by Pablo Neruda, where he's talking about the beauty of the beloved smile and, you know, what great lengths he'll go to see that smile. And so for Antara, he's remembering her smile when he sees the sword gleaming in the sunlight on the battlefield. It's a strange, strange combination, but it's written so beautifully. And the music of it, I think, keeps it in my head.
Why did you want us to hear that second poem from Lina?
Lina and I talked about how easy it is for all of our coverage about the Arab world to be about war. If the only story we're putting out on the air about the Arab world is war, then we are reinforcing a stereotype. And Lina is very gifted in being able to write about war, but also about being a parent. And not all of the poems about being a parent in her book are about coping with war. They're about just being a mom. Mm-hmm. And her voice is important for my understanding, for your understanding of what it means to be an American Muslim. So that's why it was important to me that we have both Both of these threads that are so important in her book, Water and Salt.
Well, about poetry, in that poem you played for us, Copybooks, I was listening thinking, oh yeah, our parents did teach us these rituals of complacency, I guess.
Right, our own stick figure history.
Right, but then I forget, oh yeah, the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance, that's poetry, you know? And that's part of why it's powerful, and we carry the seeds of that power in us for the rest of our lives.
Right, those things we memorized as children, they are part of our fabric.
Well, I love that you bring poetry to us, so thank you.
You're welcome, Bill. Thanks for talking with me.
You'll find audio of more poems from Lina Khalaf Tufaha's Water and Salt at our website, kuow.org. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This spring, Tacoma's deputy mayor visited a homeless encampment. And there, Robert Toms saw something that stayed with him, a woman injecting drugs openly in public. That sight eventually led Robert Toms to propose Tacoma outlaw camping on all public lands. Last night, his idea became law. Deputy Mayor Robert Toms, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
Why did seeing that woman injecting have that big an impact on you?
Well, for me, I was addressing the issue based on responses from outcries from the local business district in the neighborhood that they had this very large encampment, which was at the time underneath the I-5-705 interchange, which was one of the largest construction projects in our state. So it wasn't safe for the people down there who were simply homeless, but not only were there people that were homeless down in this encampment, but there were actually what I would consider bad actors who were commingling with the population of homeless folks. And it struck me that having, you know, folks who are homeless commingling with people who are doing illegal activities, commingling with people that may be somewhere on the spectrum of mental illness was not an effective way to address the issue of why we have folks in our city sleeping outside.
What were those bad actors doing?
Well, in this particular case, this woman was probably 8 to 10 feet from me and would appear to have been smoking out of a pipe, like a crack pipe or something, and then she started choking rather violently. And had she not recovered herself and, you know, quickly enough, I was walking over there with some others to provide assistance to her, but she sort of recovered and walked off. And then there was a bunch of drug paraphernalia throughout the encampment.
Well, illegal drug use is already illegal. Why a ban on camping in public?
Well, what we're trying to do here in Tacoma is address the issue of homelessness in an innovative way. And so about a month and a half ago, we declared a state of emergency as it relates to homelessness and trying to figure out ways to better address it than some of our other cities that we are adjacent to and others across the country. This is not something that just happens in Tacoma. Obviously, it happens in Seattle, across Washington State, and across the nation. And what this effort was is to provide additional tools to our public safety officials, so when they walk into these type of facilities, they're able to say to folks, hey, it is simply not okay for you to sleep on the streets, both in private property or public property. We have options for you, and we'd like to steer you into those options.
So you're saying that a legal ban on camping gives you a tool for steering people toward help, because otherwise they could face arrest? You're threatening them with arrest or a big fine?
No, what
fine?
It is currently, if up until yesterday when we passed this, our public safety officials would go into these encampments and say, here's what we have, but we had nothing to say, it's not legal for you to just sleep here in a public space. Right. And under private properties, there's no trespassing when properly posted, and that's currently against the law. But we had nothing similar for public spaces. And so we had people sleeping underneath overpasses. In the case of the I-5, that was WashDOT's property. And so there was some harangue that had to happen between the city and the state to make that happen. But what we set up here as part of our emergency measure, we set a stabilization center and a transition center. And had we had these two in place and had this no camping provision in place, when my folks, both in social services and with public safety, were to go into, say, an encampment, they can now say to them, sir, ma'am, here is what we'd like to do. You cannot sleep here tonight because it is not legal for you to sleep on public property. We'd like to take you to either the stabilization center or the transition center and allow us to figure out why it is that you find yourself sleeping on the streets. We believe in Tacoma that no one should have to sleep on the streets, and we don't really have a good grasp of who is actually sleeping outside now. And what I think for too long has been a systemic problem where we say for every 100, we have 100 people who are homeless. Well, out of that 100, it's my experience that 10 or 15% of them are probably bad actors that are hiding out among those people who are truly homeless. Then there's about 20 to 30 of them who are in some spectrum of mental illness. And then you are left with 50 to 60 who are truly homeless. And even in that scenario, the city of Tacoma only has roughly 20 beds in any given night that we're able to have, to populate. So we're already at a tremendous deficit, but it's not a 100-bed deficit. It's somewhere in the magnitude of, 40 or so beds.
Okay, so Robert, banning camping on public property is a means to a worthy end, but if I'm not breaking any other law, why shouldn't I be able to pitch a tent on a city park? That I can't sleep on somebody else's private land, but city land, that belongs to me. That belongs to the people.
Well, what I found and what has happened over the number of years, what I would argue is you have a three-legged stool as it relates to addressing these issues. And I would categorize the first leg as enforcement and remediation. The second leg is interdiction, and the third leg is intervention. Most people's experiences with these activities, be it the nuisance, be it people who are simply find themselves homeless for some period of time, is within that first leg, within why are they underneath my park? Why are they sleeping in front of my office? Why are they, breaking into our building? So without these types of tools, which heretofore we haven't had, and we have a situation where 95% of the complaints that we get into the city are within that first leg. Why is the city not doing anything to make sure that people aren't, sleeping on public property in my business and the like? So this is a response to outcries from many of our business districts and neighborhoods across our city. And I think it strikes a balance between more enforcement with compassion for steering these people into services. And what I think is a problem across the nation is many cities, including ours, do not have a good understanding of who the folks are that are sleeping in the streets. This isn't trying to punish people for sleeping in the streets. And in this instance, all of the new tools that we put in place sunset on October 9th, 2017.
Okay. And Robert, I'm certainly not saying that sleeping in a park is a lark. Almost no one is sleeping in a city park by choice for all the reasons you've laid out.
Yes, sir.
But do you hear from homeless people who have, I have so little, isn't being where I am a human right? Do you feel like that despite your good intentions, are you, as some people say, in effect, criminalizing homelessness?
Well, I don't characterize as criminalizing homelessness. I mean, certainly we could go further. If you went further, you could certainly have people that would say that. But what I would argue is on the spectrum of 1 to 10 of what the enforcement regime has been, mm-hmm. Let's just say for the city of Tacoma, we've been somewhere between a 1 and a 2. And this dials it up probably to a 4 or a 5. And it is simply because it is not adequate for the vast majority of citizens and businesses in our city for us to use scarce resources of law enforcement, public safety officials to simply move people along. And so rather than just move people along, we are saying to them, it is not legal for you to sleep in public spaces now. It is not healthy for you. It is not healthy for our community. And it is becoming a nuisance to those who are adjacent and live in these neighborhoods. We have services that we would like to steer you into and understand why you're here. And again, if done properly, we're going to be able to take the data and drive, instead of being objective versus subjective, we're going to be able to say, well, here are the people that we know are known bad actors. Here are the people that we believe are somewhere on the spectrum of mental illness and need additional services in that realm. And then here are the people that truly just need housing. And I don't think that there's got to be a correlation between being one, if not the most highest property crime rate in the state and having so many people living on our streets. And I believe it's being because we're not adequately understanding who's there, and we're allowing these folks to commingle. And it is not healthy for those who are homeless. It is not healthy for those people who are mentally ill. And so this is a response to get rid of as many of the bad actors as possible. When this sunsets, we're going to take it approach of assessing if we were able to change the trajectory of the number of people on the streets. Were we able to change the trajectory of crimes happening and nuisances happening in our city? And if we can attribute it to giving additional tools to our public safety officials, then we may continue it. If we do not, and there's other ways to do it, we're happy to look at that as well. But what I would argue is what we've done heretofore has not worked. We've seen a spike in all these things, and it isn't acceptable to my neighbors and most of the businesses and citizens that I talk to.
And that is why the city of Tacoma has outlawed camping on all public lands in the city. That's the deputy mayor of Tacoma, Robert Toms. Robert, thanks for coming on and explaining for us.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you for covering this important issue.
It's KUOW's The Record, a controversial story out of Canada involving a crime and an apology coming up in just a moment. We'd like to know your take on the story you just heard, anything you've heard on the show today. We're on Twitter at KUOW. You can email us record@kuow.org. The government of Canada has formally apologized to the only Canadian imprisoned at the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Canada is even paying compensation to Omar Khadr for the violation of his rights. And there's some controversy about this north of our border, and we have Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer here. Vaughn, will you tell us the story of what happened to this man?
So he's arrested in Afghanistan by U.S. military authorities in 2002. He's taken to Guantanamo. He's detained there for 10 years. He confesses to five crimes, the main one being that he threw a grenade that killed a U.S. medic, a guy who was himself a war hero, thrice decorated, and blinded another U.S. soldier. So that's what he's doing in Guantanamo. Canada brings him back after the courts in this country ruled that the Canadian government had failed to stand up for the rights and trampled the rights of a Canadian citizen by allowing him to be detained there. They bring him back. They detain him here for a while. He then sues the Canadian government for violating his rights, and the Canadian government has now apologized to him, Bill, and given him $10.5 million Canadian, which is, Americans would say, $8 million in real money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is incredibly controversial. Bill, Justin Trudeau has been Prime Minister of Canada. It's going on 2 years. This is easily the most unpopular thing he's done in those 2 years. 71% of Canadians disagree with this decision. 61% of the people who voted for Trudeau's Liberal Party are opposed to this. Outrage from one end of the country to another. The payment is one reason. That amount of money. The timing is another. The government announced this bill while Trudeau was out of the country. And they did something else that people find really, really hard to take. They delivered the cash into Khadr's hands in very short order, like within a day of the story breaking. And it is thought that they did that to prevent the widow of the American medic that he killed, to prevent the widow from going to court in Canada and getting the money sequestered. So she went to court in the United States. She and the other soldier who was injured go to court in the United States, and they get a judgment against Khadr of $134 million U.S. And so they're going to court in Canada to try to get that order instated in Canada and get their hands on the money that the Canadian government gave them.
Yeah,
government hands the money over as fast as it can. I mean, when did the government ever cut a check in 24 hours for $10.5 million?
Mm-hmm.
They hand the money over as quickly as they can to basically keep it away from the widow of his victim. So there's a lot of outrage in Canada about this one. I don't know if the damage to the government's reputation is permanent, but it's certainly the most unpopular thing Justin Trudeau has done since he became Prime Minister of Canada in October 2015.
Well, on the American side of the border, Vaughn, could you just quickly summarize what the rights are of this American widow and of the U.S. Justice Department since the grenade killed an American service member?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you know, in your system, Guantanamo and detention there is controversial. It's been controversial all along. This guy, Khadr, was a child soldier at the time. He's 15 years old. He's taken to Afghanistan by his father, who's a Taliban sympathizer. Canadian officials took part in his interrogation at Guantanamo, and that is what the Canadian courts took a particularly dim view of. The United States agreed that he could come back to Canada because he pleaded guilty. We were going to detain him here for a while, and we did. But the outstanding legal issue here, and Bill, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know how it works, but the widow is attempting to get the U.S. court order instated in Canada, so she essentially the money would then be set aside, and she would have the ability, I guess, to sue him in Canadian court. I don't know if that's possible. It's not a case for which there's an awful lot of legal precedent. I mean, generally, American court orders are enforceable in Canada and vice versa. We have treaties, tax treaties, enforcement treaties. But this one, it looks like the government, by essentially giving them the money as fast as they could, was trying to sneak around the possibility that the widow of this poor fellow in the United States who was killed. I mean, there hasn't been enough coverage, Bill, up here of who the guy he killed was. He was a sergeant in the U.S. forces, a war hero. This is a guy who was a medic, Chris Spear, who went into a minefield under fire and rescued two Afghan children. He got the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, and the Silver Star for his medical, for his military service. And a few weeks later, he's killed by a hand grenade that Khadr, at least in Guantanamo, admitted that he threw, although he now says he's not sure he did it.
Well, so we have 1 minute left, Vaughn. In summary, it sounds like more Canadians view this man as a terrorist than as a child victim of war, a child soldier.
Yeah, I think the most sympathetic thing you could say is that he's viewed as a child soldier, and there's some sympathy for that one and sympathy for Guantanamo and the court orders here. But the general view is that the Canadian government has paid $10.5 million to a terrorist and trampled the legal rights of the widow of his victim.
That's Vaughn Palmer telling you the story from the Vancouver Sun, joining us regularly on KUOW's The Record. Vaughn, good to talk with you again. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And thank you for listening. Remember, we're on Twitter, at KUOW. You can leave us a voicemail, 206-221-3663. That's 221-3663. Email us your thoughts, record at KUOW.org, and we'll use your reactions and your questions and your personal stories to drive our coverage on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.